Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Lowe's sabe que a todos nos gusta ahorrar, especialmente en esta temporada. Por eso escogimos deals buenísimos para Early Black Friday. Obtén gratis una herramienta selecta de DeWalt, Cobalt o Craftsman al comprar una batería o un kit selecto. También tenemos árboles de Navidad preiluminados selectos desde $59.98, porque nunca es muy pronto para poner el arbolito. Lowe's, nosotros ayudamos, tú ahorras. Hasta agotar existencia, selección varía por lugar.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to unravel history's tangled threads, not just retelling stories, but weaving them together so you really get the full picture.
Exactly. We want you to understand not just what happened, but why it still resonates, why it matters.
And today, well, today we're looking at something particularly dark. We're focusing on the architecture of concealment itself.
We're zeroing in on a specific moment. A moment when a house, a seemingly normal house in the American Midwest, revealed its true nature.
Not a home, but a machine.
A meticulously calibrated instrument designed for, well, for systematic cruelty.
This is the story of the night a house became a machine for hiding people. It's August 3rd, 1937, Hamburg, Ohio.
Yeah. Detective Bob Rosenthal. He went into that house looking for one missing person, a drifter named Nico Williams.
Just one person.
Yeah. Just one.
Right.
But he came out, well, he left with something else entirely, a kind of blueprint of engineered horror.
A nightmare made real.
Absolutely. What he found inside, it was a maze of brass gears, hidden levers, shifting walls. It confirmed the unthinkable. The house itself was a trap, a functional, systematic trap.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Our mission for this deep dive is to get into the context of this awful discovery. Mm-hmm. We need to detail how the inventor, Joseph Sirmitsky, actually built this hidden machine.
And what the mechanics, the specifics of that trap, tell us about his intent. What was he thinking? What was the goal?
Right. Let's set the scene first. Hamburg, Ohio, 1937.
You really need to picture the atmosphere here. It's a small Midwestern town. We're deep in the Depression era.
So life's moving slowly.
Predictably.
Very predictable. The community functions on these established social lines. Everything feels contained.
Yeah.
Safe, almost. But that feeling, it relied pretty heavily on denial. Willful denial?
Denial about what specifically?
Denial about the place at the center of it all. This aging Victorian house sitting on the outskirts of town.
So it's physically separate. Physically, yes, but more than that. It felt atmospherically separate, too. Like the normal rules of life just stopped at the property line, you know?
A place apart.
Definitely. And presiding over it all. Joseph Sirmitsky.
The inventor.
The companion notes, they just call him the reclusive inventor. Simple description, but it says a lot. He was intensely solitary. And that loneliness, you could feel it. The community felt it.
So people were uneasy around him.
Deeply uneasy. Not because he was overtly threatening, nothing like that. It was more his inscrutable behavior. You just couldn't figure him out. And that fosters unease, dread even.
He was the outsider, completely.
Totally. He wasn't part of the town's rhythm. He had his own secret life walled off inside that property. Neighbors knew of him, of course.
Did they see him often?
Occasionally, sometimes moving large, heavy things, always under cover of darkness, or they'd hear sounds. A persistent low hum. Machinery.
Machinery in a residential house.
Exactly. And that speaks to his reputation, doesn't it? Initially, they didn't see him as a monster, just eccentric.
Ah, the eccentric inventor trope.
Right. And that label, eccentric, it allows people to look away, doesn't it? It gives permission. He was a creator, yes, but as one source notes, he created machines no one should build.
And the Victorian house was the perfect shell.
The perfect cover to hide the true scale, the true purpose of whatever he was building inside.
Okay, let's move into Act D then. The quiet and ease. The final trigger. Because this isn't just about a crime scene. It's about how a systemic horror could be, well, tolerated for years.
Tolerated, ignored, rationalized away. That toleration, that avoidance by the community, that's the key psychological piece here.
Because the period leading up to August 37, it wasn't silent. There were signs, anomalies.
A slow, unsettling buildup of data points, things that didn't quite add up. But the town, collectively, it seems, they actively chose to suppress them, to not connect the dots.
Let's talk about those unexplained noises at night. The sources mention late-night clanks, specifically clanks.
Yes. And think about it. A small, pretty quiet rural town in the 1930s, ambient noise is low, very low.
So a metallic clank, heavy machinery sounds, that would carry.
It would carry far, especially late at night. Neighbors reported hearing things often between midnight and 3 a.m. That timing suggests heavy work, right? Work needing darkness for concealment.
But instead of thinking someone's building something industrial in there,
they rationalize it had to be a faulty furnace, or maybe just the old house settling, those timbers groaning, or just, you know, eccentric, tinkering, anything mundane.
They reached for the domestic explanation because the alternative.
The alternative that someone was engineering the environment, operating heavy machinery inside a home, was just too disturbing. Too destabilizing for their world.
Yeah, it wasn't just the noises. There were the disappearances.
Paired with the noise, yes. Starting noticeably in the early 1930s, a series of people just vanishing.
Who were these people?
Often drifters, transients, sometimes locals on the margins. People less likely to be missed immediately or whose absence could be easily explained away.
So not prominent citizens whose disappearance would trigger a huge search?
Generally, no. When a known community member vanishes, there's usually an outcry, a search. But when a drifter disappears, the assumption often defaults to moved on or met with misfortune somewhere else.
And that's how the community's blind spot formed.
Exactly. It's a normalization of the unacceptable. The inventor's reclusiveness, oh, he's just shy, or a genius maybe, the clanking noises, just minor mechanical issues, the disappearances, tragic, but probably just the hardship of the road. Common misfortune.
So the system of cruelty Sir Miskew was building, it thrived in that gap, the gap created by everyone looking the other way.
We see this pattern in source materials again and again in cases like this, that denial. It's required to avoid conflict, to maintain that sense of order, even if the order is false, and it lets this extraordinary darkness fester, sometimes right next door.
They lived with the possibility of terror because facing it was harder. Confronting Samitsky, confronting what might really be happening in that house, it was easier to just not.
Easier to let the unease remain a low hum in the background.
So, this silence, this avoidance, it went on for years. What finally broke it? What was the trigger that forced someone, forced the town, to look directly at the house?
One specific disappearance, Nico Williams.
The drifter Detective Rosenthal was initially looking for.
That's the one. Unlike some of the earlier vanishings, which were maybe vaguer, Williams' case had a very specific, undeniable link to Sermitsky's property.
Perhaps so.
He was seen, last seen by a reliable witness, apparently seeking shelter near the edge, the perimeter of the Victorian house grounds.
Ah, so it wasn't just a general missing person in the area. It was missing, last seen right there.
Precisely. That specificity, that geographical anchor, it pushed things past the usual threshold. Local authorities, maybe Williams's family, if he had any nearby, they couldn't just write this one off as generalized misfortune.
It's a suspicion which had maybe been floating around vaguely, suddenly had a focal point, Sermitsky's house.
And that's where Detective Bob Rosenthal comes in, local law enforcement. He likely knew the town's whispers, the longstanding nervousness about the place, maybe felt it himself.
He probably knew this wasn't a simple runaway case.
I'd imagine so.
Yeah.
He makes his move on the night of August 3rd, 1937, under cover of darkness.
So not a formal approach. No warrant knocking on the front door.
Doesn't seem like it initially. More like reconnaissance. Driven by years of this nagging doubt, finally crystallized by Williams' disappearance.
Okay. So he approaches the house. It's dark, imposing.
Right. And he finds an entry point. An open basement window.
Open? That seems careless for someone supposedly so secretive.
It's interesting, isn't it? Maybe overconfidence? Maybe he felt the real secrets were so well hidden an open window didn't matter? Or perhaps it was bait? We don't know. But Rosenthal takes it. He slips inside.
And the moment he's in that basement,
everything changes. The ordinary world ends. The mechanical world begins. His first impression, it's right there in the source notes. The basement looked like both a workshop and a trap at the same time.
Workshop and trap. That duality is chilling.
It really is. Because you walk into a normal basement, you expect storage, right? Cobwebs, maybe some old furniture, a furnace.
Yeah, your workbench and tools, wood scraps, the debris of normal life.
Exactly. But Rosenthal finds industrial intent. The workshop part wasn't just clutter, it was meticulous. Specialized tools, lathes, precision instruments, heavy-duty mechanical components laid out.
Okay, So organized, purposeful, but what made it feel like a trap?
The sheer incongruity of it all, finding industrial-grade machinery in a residential basement, and heavy wiring, thick cables disappearing into walls where you'd only expect plumbing or basic electrical. It felt wrong. Engineered, yes, but for concealment, not construction.
Engineering applied to deception.
Precisely. Which brings us right into Act Two, the workshop and the hidden lever. We need to dive into that environment because the mechanics, they're the key to understanding Sumitski.
Okay, receipt one, the inventor's fever dream. You said it wasn't just cluttered.
Not at all. Forget dusty, forgotten cellar. This place was active, maintained. This was the engine room. And it was filled, absolutely filled with odd contraptions, systems built for one purpose, motion, concealment.
And the specifics mentioned are belts, brass gears, pulleys, and odd electrical panels. Let's break those down. Why these things in 1937?
Okay, let's start with the brass gears. Why brass? Steel would have been cheaper, probably stronger.
Right.
But brass has a couple of key advantages, especially in a potentially damp basement. One, it resists corrosion much better than steel. Two, and this is critical, brass gears mesh and operate with significantly less friction and therefore less noise than iron or steel.
Less noise. He needed it quiet.
He needed quiet operation. He probably only wanted the mechanism to groan when it was making the big moves, activating, not humming away constantly. So brass points directly to secrecy, long-term function in a damp place.
Okay, so the brass gears connect to the pulleys.
Likely, yes. The gears and pulleys together suggest a system designed to multiply force enormously. Think about it. You're not just turning a small spindle. You're probably driving a heavy-duty system, maybe a worm gear or a screwjack, something capable of exerting immense, slow, controlled force.
Force enough to move?
Yeah.
Walls.
Exactly. Force enough to move entire sections of load-bearing Victorian house walls. We're talking massive weight, converting relatively small amounts of rotational energy from a motor into huge, slow, horizontal or vertical movement.
And the power for this, those odd electrical panels. What's odd about them in a 1937 house?
Well, in a typical rural home back then, especially in the outskirts, electrical systems were basic. Lights, maybe a few outlets. These panels Rosenthal saw, they suggested something else entirely. Industrial-scale power draw.
How could he tell?
Probably saw heavy-gauge copper wiring, much thicker than needed for domestic circuits. Running to these panels, the panels themselves might have had multiple relays, maybe even timing devices, heavy switches, not just for turning on a light bulb. These were controlling a high-torque electric motor, almost certainly. The kind needed to power the gear system to move those walls.
Wow, so the whole setup screams deliberate, engineered concealment.
Absolutely. This wasn't some hobbyist tinkering. This was obsessive engineering. Sumitski wasn't just a criminal. He was an engineer focused entirely on creating a perpetual concealment machine. He built something, as the source says, no one should build. And that basement was its beating heart.
You have to think about the dedication, the hours spent down there. Maintaining those belts, lubricating the brass gears, keeping the electrical contacts clean in the damp.
His life wasn't about living in the house in a normal sense. It was about servicing the machine inside the house. That was his purpose.
And the terrifying function of that machine became clear when Rosenthal started searching properly. He wasn't initially looking for architectural controls, right?
No, he was looking for evidence related to Nico Williams. Bloodstains, a discarded wallet, anything like that. Standard procedure. But instead, he finds the control panel for the whole horrific enterprise.
Locating the activation device.
He finds a lever, described as hidden behind debris.
Just debris, not locked away.
Seems like it, which is interesting. Not a complex lock, but camouflage. Maybe old canvas sheets, rusted tools piled up, scrap wood, something easily moved by Sumitski, the operator, but obscuring the lever from casual view.
So, operational convenience over absolute security.
Potentially, he needed to access it, maybe for maintenance, maybe for activation. This lever was the master switch. Only he was meant to find it, to use it.
But Rosenthal finds it. And driven by, well, who knows, curiosity, instinct, he pulls it.
Activating the machine. And the description of what happens next, it's pure tension in the sources.
Immediate.
Immediate and physical. A sound of immense strain, movement. The sources say the house changed, walls groaned, panels shifted.
Imagine that. Alone in the dark basement of this creepy house. And the house itself starts moving around you.
The dust of decades shaking loose, the smell of old oil, maybe ozone from the motor, the sharp screech or clang of heavy metal parts engaging or disengaging, the structure itself demonstrating its hidden hostile capability.
It's the house becoming the monster.
And that groan. If the brass gears were for quiet operation, the groan must have come from the building structure itself. The wooden timbers, the plaster, under immense stress as entire wall sections slid on hidden tracks. This wasn't subtle. This was the house articulating its secret function, loudly.
And in that moment, the genius, the horror of Sermitsky's design is undeniable. It's intentional. Deliberate, engineered to conceal.
He built deception into the foundations, turned a passive building into an active participant in the crime, an active trap.
The walls weren't just hiding secrets anymore. They were moving to enforce the inventor's will, a theater of mechanical horror.
Revealing what had been hidden for years.
Which takes us from the engine room to Act 3, the architecture of containment. What did Rosenthal see when those walls groaned open?
Receipt 2. Revealing the trap devices. And what he saw was chilling because it was so practical, so engineered.
These weren't just closets or crawl spaces.
No. These were purpose-built structures, sealed units, designed for containment, and ultimately elimination. The source notes use that phrase, devices for containment. It emphasizes the function.
And the description is clinical.
Very tight clinical detail, the notes say, which underscores the cold, methodical nature of it all. Let's look at the construction. Narrow lined spaces.
Narrow suggests efficiency, minimizing the space needed.
Exactly. Economy of space. Designed to hold a person vertically, maybe crouched. Less volume means the moving architecture required could be smaller, maybe less complex or power hungry.
And the lining, what was the purpose of that?
Good question. It suggests soundproofing, maybe, or possibly just protection for the structure. But given the context, the noise complaints, it's highly probable the lining was insulating material. Heavy felt, maybe thick canvas, something to muffle sounds.
Muffle cries, screams, when someone was first trapped.
That seems horrifyingly likely. Muffle the sounds before the main architectural panel slid back into place, sealing it completely, maintaining that community blind spot.
So he wasn't just moving walls, he was managing the acoustics of the horror.
Seems so. And the entry points to these devices, they were sealed by cramped metal doors.
Metal, not wood.
Right. Metal means security, permanence. Wood could be kicked through, eventually damaged. Metal suggests long-term inescapable confinement, built to last.
And the evidence of use, the rusted locks, what do they tell us?
The rust is fascinating. It suggests that once sealed, these compartments were left sealed for a long time. Long enough for damp basement air to cause significant rust. It points to a process of permanent closure. The person is contained, the metal door locked, the main wall panel moves back, and the event is architecturally erased.
Erased. And the contents confirm this wasn't a one-off.
Tragically, yes. The sources mention finding small pads of bedding.
Bedding, suggesting captivity, not instant death.
It suggests periods of captivity, yes, not just capture and immediate disposal. Minimal padding, maybe just enough to prevent noise against the metal, taking up little space, but it points to duration, a long, slow wait inside that cramped, dark space.
And then, the definitive proof.
The remains and personal effects found within those narrow compartments.
Establishing the pattern, not an isolated act.
Undeniably, the house wasn't built for one crime, it was built for a career. The remains likely correlated with those rumors, those disappearances going back years. Nico Williams was just the latest, the one that finally triggered the investigation.
The sheer horror of it. A machine designed to hold people, silence them, and then hide the evidence forever.
Yeah.
Human erasure, mechanized.
Sermitsky wasn't just hiding bodies. He was engineering the memory of life out of existence, taking a living person and converting them mechanically into a hidden architectural feature. Behind a moving wall.
It speaks to such profound detachment, treating people like engineering problems, variables to be managed, contained, removed.
Absolutely. And that systematic approach, that's what elevates this. It's beyond impulsive violence. This was planned, long term. He relied on the house itself being the secret, believing it was impenetrable as long as the town kept looking away.
Which brings us to Act 4. The machine reveals its secrets, the walls stop moving, and then the human element returns. Receipt 3, the moment of realization.
Right. Rosenthal has just witnessed the impossible, the physical manifestation of years of rumor and dread. He must be reeling. He turns, presumably to get out, get help, report this madness.
And Sermitsky's there.
He's there, standing in a corner, watching, having observed the entire discovery.
Like watching.
That's the critical moment. The machine stops, the operator appears, and the notes stress Sermitsky's demeanor. Calm, unreadable,
yeah.
And crucially, no panic, no flinch.
No panic. His life's horrific secret is revealed to a detective, and he's calm. What does that tell us?
Psychologically, it reframes everything. Analyzing his intent, his lack of reaction means he wasn't surprised, he wasn't caught off guard. This implies total premeditation, not just of the system itself, but maybe even of the possibility of discovery.
Like he almost expected this moment.
Or at least had factored it in. He wasn't reacting like a cornered criminal. He was reacting more like a technician whose complex apparatus has just been inspected.
That's deeply disturbing.
It implies a level of psychological dissociation that's hard to fathom. Seeing the victims, seeing Rosenthal, maybe not as people, but as inputs, outputs, variables within his engineered system. The house was his creation, and Rosenthal was just the first outsider to see its full function.
This is the core of that phrase, the horror is in the normalcy.
Exactly. The source records emphasize it. The lack of surprise on his face. The man who built these cold, mechanical traps was apparently at peace with their revelation. The cruelty was internalized.
For him, the design was the justification.
It seems that way. He saw the house as a functioning solution. Unwanted people, operational noise, concealment. These were problems he solved with engineering. His calmness reflects, perhaps, a belief in the flawlessness of his design. And this confrontation, just the next logical step in his engineered reality.
The horror shifts then from the bodies, the machine, to the mind that conceived it. Not madness, perhaps, but cold, systematic calculation.
And that leads to the cliffhanger mentioned in the sources. Rosenthal pulled the lever, revealed the nightmare, and now the architect of that nightmare is standing right there, calm, prepared. The notes clearly state Rosenthal's nightmare had only just begun.
The immediate danger shifted. From the mechanics of the house to the man who controlled them.
The mechanical trap gives way to the immediate human threat. Rosenthal exposed the system, and now Sermitsky, the master calculator, is undoubtedly calculating him, his position, his vulnerability.
From detective uncovering a crime to potential next victim, in an instant.
Creates a palpable sense of danger. He's trapped with the architect of the trap.
Imagine that, standing in that dark, oily engine room. You pull one lever, and reality rearranges itself like some kind of awful stagecraft. Walls move, air shifts, secrets pour out.
Yeah, but this stage doesn't hide props for a show. It hides people. It converts human beings into archived evidence. That's the part that really sticks, isn't it? The casual, systematic way life was just engineered out of existence by a neighbor?
Which forces us to look beyond the house itself, Act V. Why it matters now, the mirror of community blindness. Because the story isn't just Sermitsky and Rosenthal, it's Hamburg, Ohio.
The implications ripple outwards. The stakes are bigger than the victims, bigger than the inventor. The real enduring horror is how this complex, systematic cruelty operated right there, beneath daily life for years.
And it could only operate because the town failed to connect the dots.
His mechanism depended on their denial. We're talking about the shattered trust of a community. Think about those neighbors hearing the late night clanks, seeing the disappearances, choosing to dismiss it all as bad luck, eccentricity, someone else's problem.
They were, unintentionally maybe, but effectively collaborators in the concealment.
They chose comfort. Comfort over the deeply uncomfortable act of confrontation, because confronting Sermitsky's house meant confronting a darkness that would shatter their worldview, their safety, their trust in normalcy, their neighbors. It was just easier to believe the noise was a loose pipe.
And the sheer complexity of Sermitsky's machine.
Yeah.
It almost required an equal complexity of denial from the town. It's one thing to ignore a single shout, a single act, but he built a system, slow, methodical, hidden by architecture, and aided by society's willingness to label him eccentric and look away.
Mm-hmm. Which is why this case, this story, becomes such a powerful historical mirror. It forces us to look at ourselves even now. How do we, today, with all our information, still miss warning signs? How does our own assumption of normalcy allow terrible things to persist, hidden in plain sight?
Because complexity needs concealment, and concealment thrives on the indifference of witnesses. Sermitsky built the machine, yes, but the community, through its avoidance, helped build the environment where he could operate without scrutiny.
It's fascinating, isn't it? They looked at that house every single day, saw the structure, maybe saw Sermitsky himself. But looking isn't the same as seeing.
Not until Rosenthal.
Only Rosenthal, by going inside, past the facade, and physically pulling that lever. Only then did someone truly see what that house was built to do.
That physical action broke the spell. Broke the architectural reality, the psychological denial. Without that lever being pulled, the system just continues.
Precisely. So the Sermitsky case holds up that mirror. On one side, you see the town's blind spots, its institutional denial. On the other, you see the inventor's cold, systematic, mechanical cruelty laid bare. He perfected the mechanics of forgetting.
And the community helped perfect the context for forgetting.
Yeah.
So if we have to boil this whole horrifying deep dive down to one line, one lever revealed more than just a machine. It revealed how easily a town can be emptied one person at a time and just how slowly the truth can travel.
I think the ultimate terror, for me, it isn't just the gears in the hidden rooms. It's realizing that years of human life, actual lived experiences, were meticulously engineered out of existence by a neighbor, someone who perfected the mechanics of making people disappear, turning architecture itself into an instrument of erasure.
August 3rd, 1937. The night a detective pulled a lever.
And everything changed.
You can find the full timeline, the receipts detailing the architecture, Sierminski's methods. It's all in the episode notes.
And follow @InspectorStory for the full reconstruction, the source notes, if you can stomach the details.